Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 1 through 23. The entire chapter we'll cover. This chapter covers miscellaneous legal matters. For example, how atonement should be made for unsolved murders, what Israelites should do about marrying female captive slaves, about an unloved wife in a polygamous relationship, about rebellious sons, about a man hanged on a tree left overnight, all kind of interesting stuff. Our context is this. In the last chapter, Deuteronomy 20, we looked at the laws concerning warfare, which we'll take another look at here in this chapter 2 by way of review. So let's begin now, Deuteronomy 21, verses 1 through 4. If a slain person is found lying in the open country in the land which the Lord your God gives you to possess, and it is not known who has struck him, then your elders and your judges shall go out and measure the distance to the cities which are around the slain one. It shall be that the city which is nearest to the slain man, that is, the elders of that city, shall take a heifer of the herd, which has not been worked, and which is not pulled in a yoke. And the elders of that city shall bring the heifer down to a valley with running water, which has not been plowed or sown, and shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley. Now this corpse has been found in the open country, and of course murders are much easier to conceal in an open country. It's not known who struck him. And of course this situation is different if there was a murder in which there were witnesses. Because it took two or three witnesses to convict, there probably wouldn't be two or three witnesses in the open country. So the murderer has gotten away with murder and nobody knows who did the murder. Then in verse 2, elders and judges go out from the city that's closest to where the body was found. Those elders are probably elders of the nearest city, not necessarily elders from Jerusalem, although that might be disputed. Elders and judges are probably a group of people, some of whom were judges and some of whom were elders. The term was probably not meant to be mutually exclusive. In other words, some elders were judges and some judges were elders, but there were some elders who weren't judges and some judges who weren't elders. Now, why would this dead body be there? John Gill suggests that maybe there was a duel out there, not necessarily just a murder. I didn't know Israelites had duels. The last duel in Western civilization happened right down the street from where I live, the famous Cash duel. I forgot the other guy's name. Interesting story. I used to pass by the monument every day on my way to work teaching. The South was an honor society, just like England used to be. And the idea is you impugn my order, my honor, and so therefore we need to have a duel and shoot each other over it. Bunch of nonsense. But I don't know whether the Israelites did that sort of thing. Now, as far as how the murder was to be atoned for, in verse 4, the elders, well, before we go to that, we need to say, why did they need to measure the distance to the slain one to the city? Well, because there might be several cities that are potential candidates for atonement, the necessity of atonement, and so they had to measure to see which city was the closest. All right, now the city, the elders of the city that was closest, shall bring the heifer down to a valley with running water. Why running water? Well, this is my speculation. The water, running water cleanses. If you ever be in a mountain stream and you look at the water running over the rocks, notice how clean everything is, how clean that water looks. Running water cleanses, and so I think this is the idea of cleansing the city from the sin that of murder that had been committed. Now, why is it a heifer that had not been worked? A heifer is a young cow, a couple years old, because he is being offered as a sacrifice. And sacrifices, of course, had to be special, not ordinary, as you know if you've read the book of Leviticus. Now, why had that heifer not been, or excuse me, why had that valley not been plowed or sown? Well, this is a place where no work is done. It's a special place. We don't want to mix business with something as august as an execution or as the atonement for execution. Actually, the heifer is being executed in place of the unknown murderer. Same idea. You don't want to sell hot dogs at an execution. Executions are sort of august affairs, and it would cheapen the atmosphere to be selling hot dogs at an execution. So the heifer's neck was broken. They couldn't execute the murderer, the elders couldn't, so they executed the heifer instead. Now, as Jameson Fawcett and Brown point out, this provision of the breaking of the heifer's neck showed that God was very, very concerned with the shedding of innocent human blood. And so this ceremony was calculated to make a deep impression on the mind, as Jameson Fawcett and Brown said. In other words, we don't want people to think that murderers get away with murder, because in this case, the murderer did get away, and so that would look bad. As far as the concept of justice would not be served, would not be executed, and so they have this ceremony instead. We go now to Deuteronomy 21, verses 5 through 9. Then the priests, the sons of Levi, shall come near, for the Lord your God has chosen them to serve him and to bless in the name of the Lord. And every dispute and every assault shall be settled by them. Every dispute and every assault. The Levites are lawyers as well as blessers, because they bless the name of the Lord. I think that just, they bless in the name of the Lord. They don't bless the name. They bless in the name of the Lord, which means they pronounce blessings on the people. Verse 6, Deuteronomy 21, all the elders of that city which is nearest to the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley. And they shall answer and say, our hands did not shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it. Forgive your people Israel, whom you have redeemed, O Lord, and do not place the guilt of innocent blood in the midst of your people Israel. I suppose the forgiveness there that the people are asking for is the forgiveness for not catching the murderer. Or maybe they're just saying, forgive the murderer. I don't think so. I think they're saying, forgive Israel for not catching the murderer. And the blood guiltiness shall be forgiven them when they do that. So murder, unprosecuted murder, unpunished for murder, brings blood guiltiness upon the land. And in this case, the city closest to the murder. Verse 9, so you shall remove the guilt of innocent blood from your midst when you do what is right in the eyes of the Lord. All right, I mentioned these priests. God has chosen them to serve him and to bless in the name of the Lord. The priests had many duties. Of course, they handled all. They did all the sacrifices. They judged law cases. They were basically lawyers as well as religious officials, and they pronounced blessings on the people. The washing of the hands that the elders of the city did over the broken neck of the heifer. Washings of hands is symbolic of a declaration of innocence, and of course that's even in our culture now. And it was also true back in the time of Jesus, Matthew 27:24, when Pilate saw that he was accomplishing nothing, but rather that a riot was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd, saying, I am innocent of this man's blood. See to that yourselves. Washing his hands so he's not, now, of course he wasn't innocent. He ended up executing Jesus, but he was trying to show that he was innocent, and so he washed his hands. That was a symbol of being free from the sin. Now, Adam Clark said that Pilate probably learned this symbol from the Jews, which he very well could have, because he lived amongst the Jews for so long. Now, that would be interesting if the Jews, or God in Deuteronomy, started the symbolism, Pilate picks it up, and then from there it got into Western civilization because of Christianity, and now it came over to America because of Western civilization. And now we all say, I'm going to wash my hands of that. I have nothing to do with it. Or it could just be a common metaphor that coincidentally was applied by different people. I don't know. But let's make our main point here. Verse 8, forgive your people. Do not place the guilt of innocent blood in the midst of your people Israel. Israel was guilty if the murderers were not executed. And so since Israel was guilty, they had to have a symbolic execution. The application of this today, a criminal justice system that does not punish crime is unjust, and boy, do we have that in America, especially in these woke cities where these George Soros-financed prosecutors come in and refuse to prosecute anything, and these leftist cities that pass no bail laws so that criminals can just get arrested and walk out with no bail. It's happening all over the place, folks. And how about all the defund the police? Minnesota is just about to get ready to vote. Are they going to abolish their police department? It's total insanity. And, of course, the overwhelming number of people, including black people in the inner cities of big cities in America, people who these defund the police movements are allegedly being done in favor of, they, by overwhelming majorities, oppose defunding the police. Why? Because people cannot live in anarchy. Well, this was not anarchy, but in the case of Israel, but the idea was, we got to punish crime, got to do it. Deuteronomy 21, verses 10 through 13. We'll switch now to another topic. When you go out to battle against your enemies, and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands, and you take them away captive, and see among the captives a beautiful woman, and have a desire for her, and would take her as a wife for yourself, then you shall bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head and trim her nails. She shall also remove the clothes of her captivity, and shall remain in your house, and mourn her father and mother a full month. And after that you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. Now this is an interesting law. Now there's a question about, is this a woman taken in slavery within Canaan or outside of Canaan? If she lived in Canaan, according to one view of the laws of warfare in the last chapter, if she lived in Canaan, she would have been killed. But there's an alternative view that says that some female captives taken in Canaan would not be killed. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to give you a summary of the last chapter of the laws of warfare and besieging cities and slavery versus execution. There were four situations in warfare concerning besieged cities. First situation, outside Canaan, and the city submits to terms, doesn't fight. Then the men, women, and children are all made slaves. And so in that case, there would be a possibility of a woman slave. If the city was outside of Canaan and the city decided to fight, the men were killed, but not the women and children. They were made slaves. So there's a second situation where an Israelite could end up with a female captive slave. Third situation, the city that is besieged is inside Canaan and the city submits to terms. Now, this is debated. It doesn't ever say in the text that this option was available to Canaanite cities within Israel, but assuming it was, it's an assumption. In that case, the assumption is also that the terms would be the same as in cities outside of Canaan, namely that men and women and children are all made slaves. So in that case, you would have a situation where the women were made slaves. Now, there's a fourth situation. Inside Canaan, the city is. The city fights, and after it loses, the men, women, and the children are killed. The women are killed, so there's no female slaves there. So there was plenty of opportunity for Israelite men to get female slaves for a wife. That says the man, if the man desires her for a wife in verse 11. Well, now, there's a couple of options for what that desire means. It can either mean legitimate desire or it can be illegitimate lust. Well, I'm going to assume it's legitimate desire, as John Gill says, but the law has provisions to make sure it was not lust. First of all, the potential husband was forced to wait a month to see if his passion would subside. Not only must his passion subside, but Gill says that also the woman must become a proselyte. So the captor had to pass two hurdles in order to get that slave for his wife. His passion had to still be there after a month, and we're going to see she's going to be looking pretty ugly for a month. But his passion had to remain there, and she had to become a proselyte. Now, I don't know how Gill knows that. I don't think that's in the law anywhere. That's in rabbinic literature. But at any rate, if he could manage those two things, he could marry her. And as Gill points out, the shaving of the head would reduce the man's passion. We're going to look at some other provisions here in these few verses that will also show, allegedly or by assumption, that the wife's desirability would be, or the potential wife's, the slave's, desirability would be reduced for that month, to make sure that the man is just not going to take that slave and rape her and leave her, just use her. Now, of course, this law of the captive female slave may have only been a permissive law because of the hardness of their hearts. In fact, that's what most of the Old Testament law is, basically. Permissive law because the people were so sinful it was being regulated. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit, in just a bit. But we need to realize that this is just, it's regulating an unfortunate situation where a woman is taken a slave in war. War is unfortunate. Slavery is unfortunate. But the law here lessens the severity of those unfortunate situations. A man could not just take a woman captive. She could not be used like chattel, as Adam Clark points out. Now, this man has taken a wife. Now, usually Israelites were not allowed to marry any woman from an adulterous nation. I don't have the site, but I know that's true. But here, they could marry captives who became their slaves. Now, why the difference, I ask? This is my speculation. I would think that a slave would have less influence towards idolatry than a free woman would. If you marry a slave, you can influence the slave to worship Yahweh much easier than if you married a free woman who might say, well, my God's back from where I'm from. We worshiped Astarte. That's just my speculation. Take it for what it's worth. Now, this woman, for the month that she's staying in her captor's house before she gets married, she has to shave her head. Now, here's some options as to the symbolism of that. It could symbolize that she's leaving her former life and starting a new one as her hair grows again, has a new head of hair, new life. Well, maybe. I think more probably the symbolism is mourning, because we see that in other scriptures. For example, Deuteronomy 21:13, she shall also remove the clothes of her captivity. That's our verse here that we're talking about, actually, Deuteronomy 21:13. She shall also remove the clothes of her captivity and shall remain in your house and mourn her father and mother a full month. So there our text says explicitly that the full month was to be used for mourning, and so it makes sense that you shave your head for mourning, especially when we look at other places where baldness does stand for mourning. Jeremiah 47:5, baldness has come upon Gaza. Ashkelon has been ruined, O remnant of their valley. How long will you gash yourself? Baldness has come upon those Philistine cities in near Gaza. Gaza and Ashkelon, baldness. And of course, they're gashing themselves because they're miserable. They're mourning, and so baldness is associated with a ritual that's associated with mourning, gashing. Micah 1:16, make yourself bald and cut off your hair because of the children of your delight. Extend your baldness like the eagle, for they will go from you into exile. Of course, exile is a sad thing. It's a mourning thing. And so baldness is associated with mourning. So I think the symbolism there is most likely going to refer to mourning. Now, the general rule was, incidentally enough, that the Israelites were not to shave their head for mourning. They were not to be bald for mourning. Deuteronomy 14:1. You are the sons of the Lord your God. You shall not cut yourselves nor shave your forehead for the sake of the dead. Well, the Israelites couldn't shave their heads to show mourning, but this captive slave did. And you ask, well, why? What's the difference? Well, that's because the slave was a pagan, and that's what pagans did. They shaved their heads. The Israelites were to be kept separate from that. They were not supposed to shave their head when they mourned. Another option is the symbolism of the shaved head, as it just refers to the humiliation of the slave. That's closely related to mourning. You mourn, and you're humble when you're mourning. So that's just another way of saying option two there, mourning. Here's a scripture referring to this, or illustrating this, Isaiah 7:20. In that day the Lord will shave with a razor, hired from regions beyond the Euphrates, that is, with the king of Assyria, the head and the hair of the legs, and it will also remove the beard. So Assyria is going to shave Israel's head, hair, and legs, not only bald in the head, but also bald on your face and on your legs too. So baldness is a symbol of humiliation and mourning. Adam Clark suggests that the baldness of the female slave was a symbol of her renunciation of her old religion. And he says that's still a custom in the East. I'm assuming he's right. Well, that makes sense. And it all kind of fits together. You're mourning because you lost your parents. You're mourning because you lost your old religion. You're mourning because you lost your old homeland. And so you shave your head because shaving your head symbolizes mourning. Now, one other thing was done by the slave during this month. She cut her nails, verse 12. Now, here are three options as to why the nails were cut. Option number one, cutting the nails was a symbol of the renunciation of heathenism. Now, I don't know why. I'm not sure which commentator gave me that idea. But assuming they're right, that would be one option. Option number two, cutting the nails or trimming the nails should not be translated that way. It should be translated, let her nails grow, which is exactly the opposite of cutting. Well, I became suspicious of that, so I looked up the Young's literal translation, and the literal translation is, she shall prepare her nails. So that shows that the Hebrew is not precise. It does not precisely mean trim her nails, so it could mean to grow her nails. And why would she let her do that? Well, one reason would be to make her ugly, to make sure the husband's passion is not only temporary. That's assuming you think long nails are ugly. Of course, most women think long nails are pretty, so I'm not sure that's a good reason for letting her nails grow if you translate it that way. Adam Clark says, quote, whether this signifies paring, trimming, or letting them grow is greatly doubted among learned men. Possibly it means neither, but coloring her nails, staining them red with a henna. Well, again, why would she stain her nails red? That's supposed to make women attractive, or at least it does in our culture. Maybe not back then, but in our culture it does. Well, I think option number one, she cuts her nails because she's renouncing heathenism. Option number two, no, she's growing her nails to make her look ugly, so it'll restrain the captor from raping her. Option number three, the trimming of the nails was a symbol of mourning. Now, this makes sense to me because if women back then are like they are now, most women like long fingernails and that. They paint them. They like to look sexy with them, you know? But you got cut fingernails, that would go along with a bald head. I don't look so good now because I'm mourning. I'm not in the market for love because I'm mourning. So, captor, stay out of my bedroom. Now, there's one other thing that happened to this slave for the 1 month she was there. She has to get rid or she has to remove the clothes of her captivity while she's in that month. Now, why would she need to do that? The NIV translates it, the clothes that she was wearing when she was captured, the clothes of her captivity, and Gill translates it the same way. Now, why would she need to do that? Well, that's my speculation. She may have dressed up in anticipation of being captured. She's thinking to herself, I don't know how this siege of my city is going to go. I could lose. Well, I want to look as hot as I can when the enemy comes in so they won't kill me, or so that maybe they'll marry me instead of raping me. But this law here in Deuteronomy 21, verse 13 says, dear lady, female slave, you have to take off your beautiful clothes because we're trying to make you look ugly for this month so we can be sure that this guy who captured you is in love with your mind and not with your body. We go now to Deuteronomy 21, verse 14. It shall be, if you are not pleased with her, this again is God talking to the Israelite, if you're not pleased with her, then you shall let her go wherever she wishes. But you shall certainly not sell her for money. You shall not mistreat her because you have humbled her. Now, verse 14 of Deuteronomy 21 could be interpreted in such a way that it sort of contradicts what I've been saying about the woman being made ugly so the man would leave her alone and not have sex with her. Well, we'll look at that now. First of all, we've got to see what humbled means. The NIV says humbled means dishonored. The captor of the female slave has dishonored her. Well, if he's dishonored her, if dishonored means having forced sex with her, that sort of ruins the argument about why she was made ugly for the month. Well, or it could be the captor never was planning to marry, but he just thought she was beautiful, so he had sex with her against her will, even though they weren't married. Well, that would be a dishonoring, a humbling of the female slave. Gill says it does mean forced sex 12 other times. The Hebrew word refers to forced sex, and he gives 12 instances in the Hebrew scriptures. Now, there's another possibility that word humbled might mean socially humiliated because of the shaving of the hair, the cutting of the nails, and so forth. And she would go through that ritual for 1 month, and then the man says, oh, don't want you. I didn't have sex with you, but I've decided I don't want you. You're too ugly. Well, for whatever reason. And so he sends her out and humiliated her. Could be. So we're not really sure what that humility stands for. It could refer to forced sex with no intention to marry. It could be referring to no forced sex but social humiliation because there was an intention to marry that was not carried out at the end of the month. But whatever it was, he sends her on her way. Now there's another situation we have to deal with here. You're not pleased with her, not pleased with her when. There are two options as to when that might occur, before the marriage or after the marriage. Well, it could be after the marriage. Let's say he goes through the month. He puts up with her ugliness. He says, nah, it's all right. She'll be pretty. She'll love me when I marry her. He doesn't have forced sex with her. He keeps her honorably. He marries her and then, ooh, I don't like this woman. I don't like the way she cooks my toast. And so he dishonors her by kicking her out. And that would be a dishonor because she is put out. Now, John Gill says many people think that even after she gets married, the man has had forced sex with her, and so now she's humbled or dishonored because she's had sex before she got married. Whatever. But if he was not pleased before marriage, that could again be with after having had sex with her or after having not had sex with her. But the point is, the man doesn't even want her as a slave. Boom, out she goes. Out she goes. And she would go out as a free woman, not as a slave. Here's what the man could not do. He could not keep her as an unloved wife. If his passion has gone, he won't marry her. He could not sell her as a slave. He couldn't keep her as a servant in his house. He had to let her go. Now, this is one more example of how the Old Testament law protected women. Now, he couldn't sell her after he's kept her for a month, but he could have done that upon her capture if he had not proposed marriage, if he had just said, oh, we're not going to go through this bald business. I'll just sell her on the slave market right to start with. He could have done that, but not after he's taken her through that ritual. We go now to Deuteronomy 21, verses 15 through 17. If a man has two wives, we're moving to a different subject now, the one loved and the other unloved, and both the loved and the unloved have borne him sons, if the firstborn son belongs to the unloved, then it shall be in the day he wills what he has to his sons. He cannot make the son of the loved the firstborn before the son of the unloved, who is the firstborn. That's a little bit confusing. Basically, he can't shift. He can't say that the afterborn son of the second wife, the unloved wife, he can't give the inheritance, the double portion, to that afterborn son just because the afterborn son's mother is more loved than the firstborn son's mother. Verse 17, chapter 21, but he shall acknowledge the firstborn, the son of the unloved, by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the beginning of his strength. To him belongs the right of the firstborn. Now, I just assume there that the two wives were two wives of a man in a polygamous relationship. John Gill suggests that, and I think he's right. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says, nope, it's two wives, the first wife being deceased. Well, I guess it would apply to that situation, too. The law is ambiguous. It doesn't say. But I think that Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown is postulating that this is the case of a deceased wife and a living wife because he doesn't want the Old Testament to be sanctioning polygamy in any way. This is what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says. Quote, this case has no bearing upon polygamy, which there is no evidence that the Mosaic Code legalized. To which I say that's nonsense. Of course the Old Testament code legalized polygamy. Polygamy is everywhere in the Old Testament. I found a great internet article on this by Dr. Heiser. I forgot his first name. This guy's an interesting guy. He has a lot of off-the-wall stuff, some fringe stuff. In fact, one of the buttons on his webpage is fringe this or fringe something. It's got stuff about the paranormal, the pure normal, he calls it. And he's got fringe theology, all kind of interesting stuff. He's a brilliant guy. He came to a friend of mine's church and spoke, and I watched some of the video of that talk, and I said, this guy is over my head. He's a deep one. But anyway, what Heiser says is that just because the Old Testament law regulated bad things, it doesn't mean God approved those bad things. For example, in the Old Testament, we see war, divorce, slavery, polygamy, attitudes believing that women were unequal. Do we really think that God was in favor of all that just because he tried to regulate it? Now, this is something that skeptics, atheists, love to point out. Oh, look at that terrible God in the Old Testament. He's a homophobe. He's a xenophobe. He's a genocidalist. He likes slavery. Their arrogance will be, of course, one day paid for if they don't repent before they die, and I hope they do, but if they don't, there's going to be hell to pay for that kind of thinking. Here's what Heiser says, quote, it just was what it was, and God didn't care to alter the culture in which he was dispensing revelation. That is, getting rid of polygamy, or slavery, or attitudes about the inequality of women, etc., was not a precondition to working with human beings. The Bible doesn't prescribe a specific culture. Cultures are the product of humans, not God. A culture is evident in the biblical text because those were the people God spoke to and through, not because God invented it to be handed down to posterity. Oh, what a great quote. I admit I've had trouble with this too, looking at all that Old Testament stuff. I say, oh, God, why did you put up with that? Well, that was a different culture. They were a lot more barbaric back then. That was several thousand years ago. And now, after a couple thousand years of Christian influence, and if you don't believe that Christianity hasn't had an influence for the softening up of sinful human race, well, you haven't read ancient human history, you haven't read Western European history. And the reason we got democracy, the reason we got the rights of man and human rights and the Bill of Rights and all that kind of good stuff is because of Christianity. That didn't exist back then, so God had to take the people where they were and regulate the situation so that it was better than if he had not regulated it. All right, let's look at this unloved wife. This is another example of protection of women. Female slaves were protected previously, and now unloved wives are going to be protected. First of all, we need to note that Scripture does not approve of a man not loving one of his wives. Of course, this is just stated as a situation that happens, not that God approves it. Now, here's an example in the Old Testament of an unloved wife, the famous example. Jacob loved Rachel more than he loved Leah, and Leah was the firstborn. She was the oldest wife, and her son was the firstborn, Reuben. Ah, but you say, we have a problem here. The firstborn was Reuben, Leah's unloved wife, Leah's son, but he didn't get the double portion. He didn't get the inheritance, the double portion inheritance. Why is that? Well, there was a special case here. Reuben, the man who should have inherited the double portion, he shacked up with his father's concubine, Bilhah, which was really a dumb career move. Genesis 35:22. While Israel was living in that region, Reuben went in and slept with his father's concubine, Bilhah, and Israel heard about it. Some speculate that he did that because he's trying to give more precedence to Bilhah, because Bilhah belonged to Rachel, not Leah. He was trying to take over the rights of Jacob, because when you slept with your father's concubine, that means I'm in charge now. That's what happened. For example, remember Absalom did that when he was trying to take over from David. Slept with David's concubines on top of a roof where everybody could see it, which is a great story. Should have arrested him for indecent exposure. But at any rate, that's why Reuben did not get the double portion. Normally, the double portion went to the firstborn of an unloved wife. Well, the firstborn, the double portion went to the firstborn of any wife, whether she was unloved or not. Now, the double portion inheritance, that's not really primogeniture, because the whole inheritance doesn't go to the first son, as it happened in medieval Europe, for example. But many countries in the ancient Near East did this, gave a double portion to the older son. Now, receiving that double portion was tantamount to succession. In other words, the estate is now being passed down to you, the son. Now, an interesting illustration of this concept is seen in 2 Kings 2:9, when Elisha succeeded Elijah. We read in that passage, after they had crossed over, Elijah said to Elisha, "Tell me what I can do for you before I am taken from you." So Elisha answered, "Please let me inherit 2 shares of your spirit." In other words, a double portion of the spirit. That's a verse that the charismatics quote all the time. "Oh God, give me a double anointing. Give me a double portion of your spirit." I heard that for years when I was in the charismatic movement. I didn't even realize it was coming right out of 2 Kings. We go now to Deuteronomy 21, verses 18 through 21. We're switching topics now to a rebellious son. If any man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey his father or his mother, and when they chastise him, he will not even listen to them, then his father and mother shall seize him and bring him out to the elders of his city at the gateway of his hometown. Of course, that's where all judicial proceedings happen, in the gateway. The elders sat in the gate. They shall say to the elders of his city, "This son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He is a glutton and a drunkard." Then all the men of his city shall stone him to death, so you shall remove the evil from your midst, and all Israel will hear of it and fear. Now this rebellion of the son is in wicked defiance of the 5th commandment. Deuteronomy 5:16, "Honor your father and your mother, as the Lord your God has commanded you, that your days may be prolonged, and that it may go well with you on the land which the Lord your God gives you." This is a repeat of the law in Exodus 20:12. "Honor your father and your mother. This is one of the 10 commandments, that your days may be prolonged. We also see the negative form of this, Deuteronomy 27:16. "Cursed is he who dishonors his father and mother." And all the people should say, "Amen." Well, the law here in Deuteronomy 21 says the same thing. The son is not only going to be cursed, he's going to be executed. Exodus 21:15, he who strikes his father or mother shall surely be put to death. Exodus 21:17, he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Proverbs 30:17, the eye that mocks a father and scorns a mother, the ravens of the valley will pluck it out or pick it out, and the young eagles will eat it. So it's very clear what God's attitude toward rebellious kids are. Not good. Now, John Gill has a speculation which I think is not warranted, probably, but he says that this law about the rebellious son quickly follows on the law of marriage to a captive slave girl. And Gill says that some commentators say that the reason is because the offspring of marriages and slave girls, the offspring of captors of slave girls and the slave girl, those offspring are particularly rebellious. Well, now, how can you prove that? There's so many parents that have kids that are totally unlike the parents. That's nonsense. Now, here's an interesting question. The law specifically refers to a rebellious son. What about a rebellious daughter? Would the law apply to the daughter as well? Now, this is my speculation. I would say it would not apply to daughters, because sons were more likely to raise a rebellion that would threaten Israel. And, of course, that's the purpose of the law, is to keep rebellion out of Israel to purge the evil from among them. And, of course, daughters are less likely to raise such a rebellion, so that could be one argument saying that the law only refers to sons, not daughters. But on the other hand, you could say, nah, son is just an example. The law often does that, gives examples. For example, if you stole an ox, or cow, or goat, or sheep, well, obviously that stands for anything else that might have been stolen. And likewise, the son could just be an example of all the offspring of a person, so I wouldn't argue that case either way. Although, gosh, it'd be hard to execute a daughter. But parents of rebellious teenage girls, let's don't be idealistic about that. Rebellious teenage girls are hell. So maybe the law applied to them too. Now the parent goes and says, my son is a lazy glutton. A glutton and a drunkard. Now this is, again, just an example of what the son would do in general if the son didn't listen to the parents. This is just an example of how he would not listen. Proverbs 23:20 says, do not be with heavy drinkers of wine or with gluttonous eaters of meat. I always think it's funny how the Bible tends to label gluttony as a very serious sin, which to me, having been on a diet for several months, it doesn't sound like a sin at all. It sounds like a wonderful situation to be in, but I guess that's not the way it is. Christians under the restraints of the Holy Spirit should be moderate and temperate in their fleshly desires. Now the son is to be stoned, as verse 21 says. Now that of course presumes the son continued in his rebellion, and thus the evil shall be purged from your midst. Now this idea of purging evil from the midst is everywhere in the scriptures, in the law of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 17:7, the witness's hands are to be the first in putting him to death, and after that the hands of all the people, you must purge the evil from you. Deuteronomy 19:19, you must do to him as he intended to do to his brother. You must purge the evil from you. Deuteronomy 13:5, this refers to false prophets and dreamers. You shall purge the evil from among you. When you cut them off, put them to death. Deuteronomy 22:24, this is referring to people fornicating. You must execute them and purge the evil from you. Deuteronomy 24:7, this is referring to kidnappers. You must purge the evil from you by executing them. And of course, Paul in 1 Corinthians 5:13 says, God judges outsiders, put away the evil person from among yourselves. Purge him, in other words. That's talking about the man sleeping with his stepmother. Now, here's an age-old question. Why is this law so severe? Well, to answer that, I would just say, hey, ask a modern parent who has had rebellious children. I've got a friend whose son, totally rebellious, didn't listen to a thing his parents said, got addicted to some kind of drug, the name of which I've forgotten, but it's more addictive than crack cocaine. It just made their lives a living hell. Now, of course, he wasn't executed because we're not under the law anymore, but I'm telling you, I'm sure the thought has crossed, well, maybe not the parents' minds, because after all, he was their son, but I'm telling you, people who've had rebellious children know what a serious, serious thing it is to have rebellious children. Jamison Foster and Brown point out that we should note here that the consent of both parents was required. It says in verse 29, his father and mother shall seize him and bring him to the elders of the city. If the mother didn't go along with it, the rebellious son was not going to be prosecuted. Now, you know how mothers are. Mother says her son never does anything wrong. I used to be a principal of a Christian school, and oh my gosh, dealing with mothers was a pain in the neck. My child would not have done that. Now, there were some that were very helpful, but we were even trained in our training. This is what mothers do, so get ready for it. So you'd much rather deal with a father, because fathers have got more objectivity about their sons. Now, to get the mother to go along with it, she even had to be at the end of her rope. That shows the rebellion must have really been severe. So you're talking about a very few cases this is going to happen. In fact, I doubt the law was ever carried out at all. It perhaps was mainly a deterrent so that fathers could say, hey, you want to keep this up? I'm going to take you to the elders of the gate, and they're going to stone you to death, so maybe you better fly right. We go down to Deuteronomy 21, verses 22 and 23. If a man has committed a sin worthy of death, and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his corpse shall not hang all night on the tree, but you shall surely bury him on the same day. For he who is hanged is accursed of God, so that you do not defile your land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. Now, the man was hanged. That does not mean he was killed by hanging. He was executed first. The general method of execution, of course, was stoning, and then they would take the stoned corpse and hang it up on a tree. Now, the Hebrew for hanging on a tree, as the NIV Study Bible says, doubtless means, quote, impaled on a pole. Hanging on a tree, you tend to think, if you're an American, you think of all those Westerns you watch, and you got a noose hanging out of a tree limb, and the person was hanged. No, that's not what it means. It means somehow there was a pole stuck in the ground, and the bad guy had that pole stuck through his body. He was impaled on a pole. But at any rate, you do that, and that was okay. They did that. Here's some other scriptures where it happens. Genesis 40, verse 19, within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift up your, this is Joseph talking to the baker's head in prison, Pharaoh will lift up your baker's head from you and will hang you on a tree. So the hanging, the impaling on a pole was done in Egypt. Here is a case in Persia. Esther 2:23. Now when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged. That's the two eunuchs who were conspiring against Ahasuerus, Xerxes. These two eunuchs were hanged on a gallows. So apparently this method of dealing with dead bodies, and I'm sure it was for deterrent effect, they were hung on trees. Now, in Israel, you could only hang the criminal on a tree for one day. You can't leave him up there all night for the next day. Why? Well, the NIV Study Bible speculates is because prolonged exposure of the corpse would draw too much attention to the crime and the criminal. I question that because it seems to me that deterrence would be good. In order for the deterrent effect of the law to take effect, it would be good to call attention to the crime. Hang him up there for a week. I mean, after all, that's what, for example, in England, the kings, when they would find traitors, they constantly cut off the head of the traitors and put them on a spike. And then they take them to London Bridge and then hang them on the bridge. I just read that Henry VIII, this is a novel, so it might not be true, but he was a little kid, about 10 years old or so, and he saw all those heads on London Bridge. And he says, oh, I can't wait to be king so I can hang some traitors' heads on the bridge. Well, that was the purpose, was to put the dead bodies, and sometimes they would draw and quarter the criminal and put the limbs and distribute the limbs throughout the lands. Different cities will get different limbs. So to let everybody know, this is what happens to traitors. So I don't know, taking the body down to keep from drawing attention to the crime, I don't believe that would that make sense to me. There was another reason why the prohibition. Option number 2, prolonged exposure would offend feelings of humanity and decency. Adam Clark gives a quote in favor of that. The law which required this answered all the ends of public justice, exposed the shame and infamy of the conduct, but did not put to torture the feelings of humanity by requiring a perpetual exhibition of a human being, a slow prey to the most loathsome process of putrefaction. Did ever the spiking of the heads of state criminals prevent high treason? As Adam Clark said, well, I just talked about that. Adam Clark says, all those heads on the bridge didn't stop treason. Well, that's true, but you don't know how much more treason they might have been if they had kept the heads off the bridge. So this is a humanitarian reason. Don't let that dead body up there rot, get picked on by birds and such. That's not humane for the relatives of the dead person. Option number 3 is why the corpse should not be put up all night. This is from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. The rotting body would ceremonially defile the land. And in my humble opinion, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown is right. That's why you don't leave the body hanging up more than one day. Now, this famous scripture here, 23, for he who is hanged is accursed of God, is famous because it's quoted by Paul in Galatians 3. Why is a dead body on the tree accursed? Well, because hanging on a tree represented God's judgment and rejection of the murderer's crime or the criminal's crime. It showed what God thought about these criminals, showed what he thought about those sins worthy of death, those capital crimes. It was showed to the public, and the public saw it. Now let's look at how Paul quoted this verse in Galatians 3:13. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. So Paul takes that Old Testament principle that criminals are accursed of God and says that Jesus was accursed of God because he hung on a tree too. He wasn't impaled on a stake, but he was hung on a tree on a Roman cross. And he took the curse of the law that was all that stuff in Deuteronomy 28 that comes on rebellious people, people who transgress God's law. All those curses were the punishment for those evils. The curses that come from those evils were placed on Jesus instead of on us. And ladies and gentlemen, on that fundamental, very happy note, we have finished Deuteronomy 21. In our next audio, We will discuss in chapter 22 of Deuteronomy various laws, including laws concerning sexual immorality. So I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoy this one.